This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
Most people would judge a person more harshly for a bad action done intentionally than unintentionally. Kicking somebody by mistake is not as bad, we tend to think, as kicking someone on purpose. Lian Yang is trained in philosophy, but is a rising star in psychology, based at Boston College, and her particular interest is moral judgment.
Lian Yang, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you. Hi.
The topic we're going to focus on today is mind and morality. Now, it seems quite an intuitive starting point that any kind of thinking about morality involves recognizing other people have minds.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that we do quite easily and spontaneously. We naturally think about what's going on inside other people's heads when we're interacting with them. And importantly, or of interest to me, when we're making moral judgments about what they do.
You're principally a psychologist. How did you go about investigating moral issues about the mind?
Well, one of the first things that we did was just think about our own intuitions about the sorts of things that matter. And one of the first things that comes to mind is this factor of mind or intention, so the difference between intentional acts and accidental acts and so on. And for me, this was an easy way into moral psychology because, as all of us who study morality know, morality is incredibly complicated. And so for me, I thought one way into this complicated problem of morality is to study some factor that might matter across the board. And so even if I don't know what you think is morally wrong, I know that whatever you think is wrong, you probably think that thing is more wrong when it's done intentionally than accidentally.
So, for example, if I deliberately punch somebody and knock them out, that's much worse than swinging around and accidentally my fist hitting their face.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that young children have a really difficult time doing this. So developmental work by Piaget and others showed that young children tend to make outcome-based moral judgments as opposed to intention-based moral judgments. So that was sort of a starting off point for us in looking at adult moral judgments. What we started to do was just devise a bunch of scenarios that varied systematically this dimension of intention, but also outcome. So you can imagine that in one case, I try to do something good for you, but it turns out badly. Say I try to put some sugar in your coffee, but it turns out to be poison, so I end up accidentally killing you. So on the one hand, I had a good intention, but I produced a bad outcome. You could imagine another case where I try to do something bad, like poison you, but I end up just putting what is regular old sugar in your coffee. So these are the kinds of cases that we present to our subjects, cases that vary intention and outcome systematically.
What sort of findings have you got from these experiments?
The behavioral finding is quite simple, which is simply that intent matters for ordinary moral judgments. What we started to do also is scan our subjects, scan their brains while they made these sorts of moral judgments to see what happens, and in particular, whether there are specific brain regions that are recruited for helping us do this, for helping us think about other people's mental states, like their intentions and their desires. And it turns out that that is the case. So one of these regions in particular, the right temporoparietal junction, which is a region right above and behind your right ear, seems to be particularly interested in these sorts of mental state considerations. Activity in this region seems to correlate with differences in people's moral judgments. So going back to that case of accidentally poisoning your friend because you think some substance is sugar, but it turns out to be poison, turns out that the higher the activity in this region, the more likely you are to use that information about the mental state that somebody had a false belief and a good intention to let that person off the hook.
So this is prima facie evidence that there is a part of the brain that specializes in dealing with other people's intentions.
Exactly. And some further evidence above and beyond the correlational evidence that we found using functional neuroimaging is some what I think is really interesting evidence using another method called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. So this is a method that we've been able to use to modulate activity in specific parts of people's brains, including the RTPJ. And so in this experiment, we used TMS to disrupt activity in this particular brain region to then look at the impact on people's moral judgments.
And did they turn into moral monsters?
I'm not sure about that. What we're looking at is not so much moral behavior, but people's judgments about other people's behavior. And so what we did find was the expected pattern, which is more outcome-based moral judgments rather than intent-based moral judgments. In that other case of attempted harm, where I try to poison you but fail because I had a false belief about the powder, disrupting activity to the RTBJ makes you think that that is more okay.
Is there any evidence of damage to that region of the brain affecting people's moral behavior?
So far, there haven't been any lesion studies to that region of the brain. We've done some other work looking at damage to other parts of the brain, and also more recently, we've done some work on prison inmates with a diagnosis of psychopathy. That's been particularly interesting. So just to give you a couple of examples of the patient populations, prison inmates with a clinical diagnosis of psychopathy show the opposite pattern. These folks actually are incredibly forgiving of accidents. And you might think this is strange because that seems to be a very good rational judgment that they're making. Are they even better at making moral judgments than you and I? And what I think is going on there is not that they are particularly attentive to mental state considerations, but rather because they have reduced emotional response to the pain and suffering of the victim of the accident. So typically, in a lot of cases, when we find it hard to forgive someone for causing an accident, it's because we have this gut response to whatever harm was done, and we need to override that response in order to then forgive the person for doing what they did. But if you just are missing that response to begin with, then it's very easy for you to say, that's okay.
So is a deficiency in ability to consider other people's intentions something that will put you outside the moral realm?
That's a really interesting question. So, I mean, in general, it's an interesting question as to what the moral realm even is. You might make more intention-based judgments, I might make more outcome-based judgments, and who's to say either you or I are right, or whether there's even a right answer or a fact of the matter about that. Of course, there is some normal distribution of responses, and another patient population that falls outside of that distribution is autism. We tested very high-functioning individuals with autism on these same sorts of moral scenarios, and they showed the opposite pattern from the one I described about psychopaths. So whereas psychopaths were hyper-forgiving of accidents, individuals with autism were more likely to say that accidents are completely forbidden, and that's actually a pattern that we see in young children also.
Now, those are experiments about intention, but are there any areas of morality which don't involve intention?
What's interesting about this is that when I started, like I said, I started studying intentions because I really thought that this is some factor that might matter across the board. And in a conversation with an anthropologist, I realized that that might not be the case, at least cross-culturally, or even across kinds of moral actions. What we've looked at more recently is not just harm violations or actions that harm other people, but purity violations like incest or eating taboo foods and so on. And what we've begun to see is a real difference in the role of intent across moral domains. We all recognize the big difference between murder and manslaughter, and the difference has to do with intention. But it turns out that even while people may distinguish between intentional and accidental incest, they see a much smaller difference between those two actions.
That's interesting, because I would have thought people would condemn Oedipus less for sleeping with his mother than somebody who deliberately set out to seduce his mother.
That's indeed the case. People do see a difference due to intention between those two cases, but they see a much smaller difference. I should also say that our scenarios depended on second-person versions of these scenarios. So when you consider sleeping with your sister, either intentionally or accidentally, I'm sure it doesn't matter so much to you which of those things you do. The point is just to avoid sleeping with your sister. This sort of gets at the intuition that harm norms and purity norms might actually serve different adaptive functions. We're taught to not hurt other people. And in cases where people hurt us, we really want to know, did they do that intentionally or accidentally? And we need to have this information if we're going to figure out whether to avoid them in the future or whether to be friends with them, whether to forgive them and so on. But purity norms may actually function to help us protect ourselves from, again, sleeping with the wrong people or eating the wrong things and so on. When we're concerned about avoiding negative outcomes for ourselves, I think we care less about intention.
Does that suggest there are different physiological underpinnings of these two systems of morality, as it were, the harm-based system and the purity-based one?
this hypothesis certainly makes very specific neural predictions. We can see whether regions like the right temporoparietal junction are recruited differently across these different domains. So what's happening when people are making judgments of harm violations versus incest or eating taboo foods and so on. And it turns out that while the RTBJ is robustly recruited for our judgments of murder and manslaughter and poisoning and assault and so on, the RTPJ is recruited significantly less when we're reading about purity violations like incest. Even before we read any information about the agent's intention, whether they meant to do it or not, simply reading about a purity violation seems to elicit a different pattern in the brain.
Now, I can see the importance of describing moral psychology. We need to know what's going on. But who's to say which of the various stances on the world that everybody from a psychopath to an autistic person takes is right?
I think that's going to be up to the philosopher to figure out. Either that or just the philosopher within each of us. So we all have intuitions about the kinds of principles that we want to endorse upon reflection. What's maybe not interesting about the work that I do is that a lot of people have the intuition that intentions ought to matter. And look, it turns out that they do in a lot of these cases. Thinking about moral norms in these terms is interesting because it makes me think that some moral norms may be more normatively legitimate than others. Harm norms, to the extent that we want to think about morality as important for regulating interpersonal interactions and relationships and so on, seem more inherently moral than norms that may have evolved for purposes that have nothing to do with anyone else. Norms that may have evolved for me to make sure that I don't catch some disease, that I don't eat rotten meat, that I don't commit incest and have babies with genetic problems or whatever. To the extent that that is the evolutionary root of that kind of norm, I might think differently about a purity violation as opposed to a harm violation.
What you're doing fits in with this new phenomenon of experimental philosophy. Do you see yourself as an experimental philosopher?
I do, absolutely. I think a lot of the questions that I'm interested in are also questions that philosophers are deeply interested too. I think that we may take slightly different approaches and draw slightly different conclusions. A lot of the work that I do seeks to describe how we make moral judgments and the underlying cognitive and neural processes, and I don't necessarily need to draw conclusions about what we ought to do with that information.
Lian Yang, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.